From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, revisiting the great books. Writer and film critic David Denby headed back to college to relearn the classic works of the Western tradition. His new book describes his experience and his insights into the debate about multiculturalism and the literary canon. Also, screenwriter and director Alison Anders on her new film, Grace of My Heart. It's about the songwriters of the early 60s, their lives, their loves, and how they churned out the classic pop songs of the pre-Beatles era. And Elvis Costello on collaborating with Burt Bacharach on the title song to Alison Anders' film. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. CIA Director John Deutsch says Saddam Hussein is now stronger than he was despite the face-off with U.S. forces this month. Deutsch told a Senate panel Saddam's position is strengthened with recent events in the Persian Gulf. He adds there's a shocking reluctance on the part of the U.S. allies to challenge the Iraqi dictator, and he says arms and trade sanctions have failed to weaken Saddam with his people. Republican presidential candidate Bob Dole was slightly hurt yesterday when he fell several feet from a campaign platform as a fake railing gave way. But that did not stop him from joking and delivering his speech. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Bob Dole both raised and answered questions about his physical condition yesterday. His fall, which was an accident, left him on the ground on his bad shoulder. But he got up quickly with the help of a Secret Service agent, got back up on the platform, gave a rousing speech, and shook hands for a half an hour. On the plane from California to Las Vegas, Nevada, site of his next speech, Dole joked about his spill and even asked to see the pictures, which he said he didn't want his wife to see. Dole said he felt fine and was surprised that he wasn't stiff. Asked whether it marred his campaign day, he responded, "Well, I got up, didn't I?" Dole, who is 73, has sought to quell questions about his health by releasing all of his medical records. Spokesman Nelson Warfield said the incident should put to rest questions about the age issue once and for all. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Las Vegas.
South Korean military officials say they have shot and killed 7 North Korean infiltrators. They were part of a group that landed on the east coast of the country after their submarine became stranded on rocks. At least 2 more people are still at large. Thousands of South Korean troops are still searching for them. The BBC's Charles Scanlon reports from Seoul.
A combined army and police manhunt backed by helicopters has continued for a second day in the mountains near South Korea's east coast, where the abandoned submarine was found. A defense ministry spokesman said the suspected infiltrators were killed by South Korean infantrymen. He said on both occasions the North Koreans had opened fire, but there were no South Korean casualties. The reported clashes came the day after the bodies of 11 North Koreans were discovered. A defense ministry spokesman said they appeared to have been shot by their commander, who then killed himself. There's been no official comment about the incident from North Korea. A North Korean army officer at the border village of Panmunjom refused to accept a letter of protest from the United Nations command, which represents South Korean and United States forces in the south. The South Korean president, Kim Jong-sam, has accused the North of staging a military provocation. He said it went beyond a normal case of espionage.
The BBC's Charles Scanlon reporting from Seoul. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 23.5 points at 5,853. Trading is moderate. The Nasdaq Composite Index is up nearly 3 points at 1208. This is NPR. Pope John Paul has begun a 4-day trip to France. It's the longest public appearance for the pontiff since the Vatican announced last week he will have surgery for recurring appendicitis. The pope's trip includes 4 helicopter and 5 jet flights as he moves from town to town. This is John Paul's 5th visit to France. Israeli warplanes launched 2 air attacks today against Hezbollah guerrilla targets in southern Lebanon after 4 Israeli soldiers were wounded in a guerrilla ambush. Edward Uranian reports from Beirut.
It was an old scenario that has repeated itself frequently over many months. Hezbollah guerrillas hid in the hilly terrain of southern Lebanon, then attacked an Israeli patrol. Hezbollah fired machine guns and rockets during the brief clash, and there were a number of Israeli casualties. Israeli helicopters later evacuated the wounded, and Israeli planes and artillery then bombed a nearby ridge. The only difference today is that relations between Syria and Israel are extremely tense, and any small incident could set off a crisis. Nearly a third of Syrian troops were recently redeployed in Lebanon, and Israel says it feels threatened. Syrian troops also appear nervous and say they fear an Israeli attack. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu recently threatened a vigorous Israeli response if Hezbollah stepped up its operations. For National Public Radio, I'm Edward Uranian in Beirut.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is calling for a major change in the way the polio vaccine is given. The CDC says infants should get two shots of a vaccine before getting the oral version. The CDC says the injections would cut in half the small risk of contracting polio from the oral dose. The oral vaccine is blamed for causing up to 10 cases of polio a year. The CDC says the new policy will take effect next year, and after 3 to 5 years, they'll recommend only polio shots be used. Some health groups oppose the new guidelines because the oral vaccine is cheaper and easier to administer. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bulgave. As film critic for New York Magazine, David Denby enjoys a career that many people fantasize about. But in 1991, he embarked on another enviable intellectual adventure. 30 years after entering Columbia University as a freshman, Denby re-enrolled in 2-year-long courses, Literature Humanities, which is a survey of European literary masterpieces, and Contemporary Civilization, a survey of classic works of philosophy and social theory. Out of that experience came a series of articles for The New Yorker and a new book called Great Books. We asked Fresh Air book critic Maureen Corrigan, who also teaches literature at Georgetown University, to talk with Denby about going back to school and to find out his views on the relevancy of the so-called great books to our lives. David Denby said a number of things prompted him to return to college to study the great books.
There wasn't any one reason, as there never is any one reason why one writes a book, but I was reading the culture wars debate, which now seems to have gone on for about 3 decades, with my wife in the late 80s, and Alan Bloom and Roger Kimball and William Bennett and so on, and finding it all highly unsatisfactory. It seemed to me that both left and right were talking about the books in a rather hollow and ideological way that had very little to do with the experience of actually reading the Western classics. That was one thing. And the other thing, Maureen, was I didn't realize at first, which was that I was stale in some way. I was 48, and I was beginning to feel that I no longer had an identity as a writer and even as a person, that I was living in this media society. I was part of it. I'm a film critic. I write for New York Magazine. I love journalism. I've been doing it for 25 years. I hope I'm never forced to quit. But at the same time, I was unsatisfied and felt that my identity had somehow lapsed out into this mass of imagery and representation that surrounds all of us living in a media society. And I no longer knew where I began and it ended. And I thought, well, another way of a way of finding out might be to read classic works and see how they reverberate and see if I can, you know, find myself again. So that sort of overtook the initial motivation.
Okay, so you cleared this intellectual adventure with the Columbia administration, I assume, and then you show up in September, and it's the first day of school. What was that day like for you?
Well, these courses are taught entirely in seminars. There are no lectures. That's the point, is to pull freshmen and sophomores into rather difficult texts and to get them to think on their feet. And so there's a lot of drama in the classroom. Itself, you're not just listening to some, you know, great professor talk. But I wanted to find good teachers because I thought, you know, these people are going to reappear through the whole book. And one person I found was a man named Edward Taylor, who I had in fact taken a course from 28 years earlier. Not this course, but something else, a poetry course. And I met him on opening day, and he said, "Well, come along, you know, if you're interested." And I sat there in his class for 9 months and never left. And the other was James Shapiro, another literature professor, who has a very different way of dealing. Taylor had the whole thing in his head and would sort of, it was like a gigantic poem, the course, from Homer right to Virginia Woolf. And he would make the students sort of fill out parts of the plan that he had, whereas Shapiro, much younger man, would turn on the students and say, what did you think of this book? Almost high schoolish. At first,
right.
Did you like it? I was shocked the first time. Do you like the Iliad? I mean, I never would have thought at 18 that I had the option not to like it.
Right.
And then, they would respond very naively. I mean, you're a teacher, and you know sometimes if you ask that, you get these sort of wonderfully unguarded mm-hmm. responses,
Oedipus,
right?
This reminds me of my father, that kind of thing. Right.
Excellent. Right. He would then take these responses and sort of try to work them so open, sort of turn them against the students, embarrass them, provoke them, mm-hmm. push them a little bit until he would like turn them completely inside out.
As a college professor myself, I've had the experience of having my students' parents sometimes or my own colleagues sitting in on classes to evaluate me. And it always seems to me that those classes are very self-conscious, as though I and my students are playing to the audience. So I'm not sure I would have wanted you to be in my classroom for a year. And I recall there was at least one professor at Columbia who felt the same. She called you up after you had sat in her class and said something to the effect of you being a disruptive presence in the class.
Yeah, that was entirely my fault. I blew that one. I went in and they were discussing King Lear. And the problem all year long, Maureen, was that I couldn't keep my mouth shut. I was so excited that I was doing this that, you know, my intention was to sit there and be a reporter, right? And sit there with my stenographic notebook against the wall and just take notes and listen and read. But I was brimming over. Mm. You know, this stuff was just tremendous to me. And I would raise my hand, you know, call on me.
Mm-hmm.
some of the professors welcomed it. But on this occasion, this was the first time I had entered this section. And I just went in to try it. And I said something. It wasn't nothing very important. But I noticed a whole bunch of students glaring at me. And that night, the teacher called and said, "Forget it, bub."
Yeah.
So I blew that one. But I did get involved quite a bit in some of the other classes. And Professor Shapiro, one of the literature teachers, sensing that I was perhaps beginning to compete with him, said, "Well, why don't you teach little Jane Austen?" I wondered to this day whether he wasn't actually setting me up.
From your account, it sounds like he did set you up.
Well, he's written a piece now in the Chronicle of Higher Education saying what it was like having me in the classroom, so turnaround is fair play.
Mm.
I think he was setting me up, and I tried to teach Jane Austen thinking it would be easy, and boy, was it not.
For me, one of the most terrifying moments that you describe in Great Books was when you decided to take the midterm exams in both courses. Tell us what happened.
Well, I wasn't going to do it at first because it seemed like such a no-win situation, because I thought if I did better than the students, I would feel like a cad, and if I did worse, I'd feel like an idiot. So, you know, 25 years of professional writing and all of that, so I was going to stay out of it, but people kept saying, you know, you've got to do it, it's a book, it's, you know, it's a great experience. So I decided to take the literature examination at the end of the first semester, and 3 days before the exam, I noticed that my heartbeat had tripled. I was 48 years old, you know. And I began cramming and, you know, reading everything over and wondered whether I should read secondary source criticism and so on. And then I went in at the exam and my brain went into lockup for about 20 minutes. I couldn't stand the questions. They seemed, you know, excruciating to me. Compare and contrast, you
right.
know. I'm sure you've given one of those exams.
All the time.
Yes. Remember the Mutt and Jeff of academic life. Compare and contrast. And then after the exam, after I finally got going, I went downtown and met my wife and drank, you know, about a bottle of wine. I still woke up in the middle of the night. And I thought, gee, well, you know, it's nice to know what a nervous breakdown is. So you don't want to be examined when you're a grown-up. You know, that's the thing you want to avoid more than anything.
Your account made me feel so guilty because I always go in on exam day with a cup of coffee and, you know, kick back with a book. And it's one of the most pleasant days of the year for me because everyone else is sitting there sweating. But, you weren't graded, right? You decided.
Yeah, so when he finally sent me the blue books back, I was annoyed because all he said was, "I found this very interesting to read." And I thought, well, wait a second, how did I do?
You think you passed?
You never outgrow, you know, the desire to do well and the fear of judgment.
Of course.
Doesn't matter how, if you were 70, it would be the same thing.
You know, one of the things that I was thinking of as I was reading Great Books, because you do such a wonderful job of bringing these books to life as you're talking about your experience with them, is that colleges and universities that are making the decision to eliminate these kinds of courses are doing students such a disservice. And I don't think you get into this, but one of the reasons that a lot of people have pointed out that the colleges and universities are getting rid of these courses is because of economic concerns, that if they're not popular with students, students won't take, say, a great books course in the English department. The English department gets less funding from the university. So, you know, that it's wiser to give a course, to offer courses where students seem to think that they'll have fun rather than struggling with the Iliad and the Odyssey for a month or so.
Well, I think that's a disastrous attitude, and the Columbia's response and the University of Chicago and a number of other universities that have held a course on this stuff is, is to require it. So it's no longer an issue of popularity. I mean, the assumption is not that you will fail to be a human being if you haven't read this collection of 30 or 40 texts, but that you will be a better person if you have read them. It's not the only way towards selfhood and character, but it's a good way. And I would never claim any exclusive, you know, with some of the best educated people we know have never been to college at all. So, I would never claim any exclusive, justification for such lists. But it's certainly the ideological complaints against them are hooey when you actually sit through a year and read through a year and, you know, get turned inside out by some of these books. Because the reason they've lasted so long is that they're extraordinarily powerful. And all these ideological things just disappear. I mean, these are extreme works in many cases. The Old Testament is an extreme work. Oedipus Rex is an extreme work. King Lear, the philosophy of Hegel and Nietzsche, I mean, they turn you inside out. And even students I've discovered who had some ideological problems with the courses being required, some African-American students who were upset because there were no African-American writers, for instance, said to me things like, well, you know, you'd have to be made of stone not to have been blown away by at least one of these things in each course, in each semester. And for some, it was Nietzsche. And for some, it was Marx. And for some, it was Shakespeare. And for some, you know, it was Homer. I mean, they all had their favorites. And just let me say, they were in no way, their identity as African Americans was in no way diminished by having read through 2 years of classic text written by white males. Identity doesn't work that way. If anything, it was sharpened by it. They knew more clearly who they were, both as individuals and as members of African American group. You're not diminished. Women are not diminished by reading books in which, say, like the Iliad, in which women are not, you know, central. If it's a great work, it stretches you. You have to stretch a lot of muscles to reach it because it's so far from you in many cases. And then, you know, the rest of your identity, like the blood, and rushes in to repair the stretched muscle, and you become a stronger person at the end of it.
Well, I can just visualize the thought bubbles above the heads of our listeners who are saying, that sounds great, but who's got the time for this? And I'm thinking about your situation. While you were at Columbia, you were still writing the weekly reviews for New York Magazine as well as writing for The New Yorker. You're also married and the father of two boys who were at that time, I think, pre-adolescence.
Right.
Did you fall behind in your reading?
I fell behind in everything. It was very hard to pull everything together, and I would read late at night when the children were asleep, and then get up the next morning and try to help my wife get them off to school, and then run up to Columbia, and then run to a screening. It was like that, for, you know, the whole year. I can't tell you how exhilarated I was, though, how happy I was. I felt like I was pressing against the frame of my life day after day, and that. I couldn't possibly be the same person at the end of it. So even though I was constantly out of breath and looking for a place, and I would read Maureen everywhere. I would read in doctor's offices while the children were having their teeth examined. I would read while they were on play dates. I would read standing up in the subway, you know, the way a horse sleeps. I mean, it was absurd, a lot of it. I mean, I wasn't actually accomplishing any of it because I would stand there in the subway and everyone else was reading John Grisham,
right,
who really goes very well in the subway. The sort of click-clicking of the rails, I think, moves the plot along even faster. perfect subway reading. You cannot read Plato in the subway. But, of course, a lot of this was just anxiety, you know, to try to stay up.
David Denby, talking with Fresh Air book critic Maureen Corrigan about his new work, Great Books. Let's take a short break. We'll be back in a moment. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Now back to Fresh Air book critic Maureen Corrigan's interview with David Denby, author of great books.
In preparation for talking to you today, I reread the chapter in Great Books where you discuss King Lear and the connections that you made as you were reading Lear with Lear and your mother, who had died, I guess, a year before you began this Columbia Odyssey.
Yes.
Every time I read that chapter, and it's about three times now because it was excerpted in The New Yorker, and of course it's in your book, I became conscious that I was holding my breath, because to me it's just so powerful. Would you talk a bit about how Lear gave you insights into your relationship with your mother in her old age?
Well, my mother was a remarkable person, a great businesswoman, and a very loving and generous mother. But when my father died in 1981, she went into a rapid decline, and she eventually dropped out of business, and then I got married. And she lost her power. And King Lear, at the beginning of Shakespeare's King Lear, is older than my mother, is about 80, and gives up the reins of power, gives up the kingship, and poses this absurd and disastrous test of affection among his three daughters: which shall love me the most? Mm. My mother, when she lost the power that she had through her professional career, became very, very difficult and demanded more love of me than I could easily give her. Now, it turned out she was ill, and we didn't know it. And my wife helped me to find the right doctor, and we sort of pulled her out of it the last few years. And she had 3 years or so at the end when she was much happier. But I could never quite satisfy that demand for love that she had. And reading King Lear again and seeing what happens, because we all have to undergo this transformation. You see, we're used to being, when we're younger, to being subject to our parents' power. Either they are benevolent or not so benevolent, but whether they are or not, when they get older, and we get older too, at a certain point, there's that shift where you become responsible for your parents, particularly if they become ill, and that no one is really prepared for that in life. It is a shock. Particularly if you have a mother or father as powerful as my mother was. And I didn't understand that when it was happening to me, and it wasn't until I read the play again that I began to, you know, grab hold of where I had messed up, where I was strong, where I was weak, and what my mother was going through. I can't tell you how much it illuminated my experience. And I think what I try to do in each of these chapters, and that one isn't unique, is to try to make some trial of ideas. Not just to report on the books and the students, but to take something that was said in class, something that happened in my life. There's quite a bit of autobiography throughout the book, and read it through the text. And I talk about being mugged, for instance, on the way to work, and I read that experience through the social theory text. I mean, people like Hobbes and Locke and Rousseau and Nietzsche even were obsessed with the question: what holds a society together? What pulls it apart? Why? How do we have a civil society at all? What are the threats to it? So I try to talk about crime in the big cities, being mugged, how that played out through my life.
Now, your primary job is as a film reviewer for New York Magazine. I'm
right.
wondering if being exposed to all this great literature has made you have less patience for mediocre or just plain bad movies.
It has.
Yeah.
What I was afraid of was that it would simply kill the movies altogether. And thank God that did not happen, because I would be out of a job. But during the first few weeks, I was nervous, and I thought, oh, who has time for this stuff? And I felt, oh, I don't want to really write my criticism. Mm-hmm. But I checked myself. I thought, you love movies. You're the same person now who's loving literature. There's part of you that answers to both of these things. So don't turn yourself into a fake. Don't reject yourself. And so what happened is, as your question suggested, was I became, not that I wanted to leave movies or not write about them, but I became more impatient with shoddy work, which is to say most movies, mm-hmm. with work made without any faith in the audience, without any attempt, any ambition, any artistic ambition, work that's purely designed for the marketplace, which is, unfortunately, it may be 2 out of 3 movies mm-hmm. that come down the pike. But seeing a terrible action movie didn't make me say, oh, I've got to run back and read Sophocles. It made me say, I wish I could see a good action movie.
Right, right. And in fact, especially when I'm thinking when you're describing the Iliad, it sounds like an action movie in parts.
It's much more violent than
yes,
any action movie.
Yes.
Yeah, very extreme. I was stunned by this, the spears, thrown at someone and still quaking as the heart is beating and dying. I mean, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Homer is extraordinarily explicit about, you know, where the instruments of war destroy bodies, where the spear comes in and where it comes out. And at the same time, he mixes in these longing for home and for peace and for family and for children. It's a heartbreaking poem, but it's certainly more violent than perhaps any movie I've ever seen, and right at the beginning of our literary tradition.
In one of the New Yorker excerpts, I recall you talked about reading Dickens to your son on vacation, and how, because you were away on vacation, away from TV and all of these other intrusions, it was a good experience. But the minute you got back to New York, all of a sudden life began to intrude again, and you kind of lost the thread of the Dickens novel you were reading.
Yeah, it was heartbreaking.
Yeah.
I mean, when we were away, he loved my reading to him at bedtime, and he couldn't get enough. It was Great Expectations, one of Dickens' greatest novels. He couldn't get enough of it. I mean, he would force me to read an hour and a quarter, even an hour and 45 minutes one night. There was nothing else to do except to go to sleep. And then, you know, once we got back to the city, and he had computer games and television, as well as all his friends at the other end of the telephone, and homework, of course, as well.
Right.
It fell apart. He grew less interested in it. There was less time for it. I had to recapitulate the plot. I mean, and he still loves Dickens, and he loves the language, and he was laughing a lot, but he fell out of it. And so we had to, like, start all over with something else. And he was reading Agatha Christie on his own, which is fine, because she writes quite well.
Mm-hmm.
But, part of what haunts this book that I've written, I believe, is, what are we going to pass on to our children? Can a child be happy just playing video games? Let's put it that way. Can a child be happy just living in the media? A lot of them think they're happy, and it's pretty hard to argue with someone who says he's happy, right? And tell him that he's not, that he's missing something. But I think we have the right to say you're missing something. We have the right to introduce them to things that are much more powerful than anything they know. We have the right to educate to their utmost extent, the next generation. If we don't, we will just kick ourselves terribly. So you have to make them do it.
Thank you very much, David Denby, for being our guest on Fresh Air.
Thanks for having me.
Fresh Air book critic Maureen Corrigan talking with David Denby, author of great books. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, screenwriter and director Alison Anders. Her new movie about the Brill Building songwriters of the early 60s is called Grace of My Heart. And Elvis Costello tells us how he collaborated with Burt Bacharach on the title song to Anders' film.
Well, I met you in December underneath the winter sky. I could tell by the kissing on New
Promise that.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Alison Anders says her new film, Grace of My Heart, is like a love letter to pop music of the late 50s and early 60s, and to the Brill Building in New York City, the place where most of those songs were written. Carole King and Jerry Goffin, Ellie Greenwich, Lieber and Stoller, Burt Bacharach, and Hal David all worked for little money in tiny rooms with upright pianos, writing hits like One Fine Day, Leader of the Pack, Stand By Me, and Walk On By. Anders' film tells the story of a young songwriter named Denise Waverly. The character is loosely based on Carole King. Ileana Douglas plays the role of Denise, and the cast includes Eric Stoltz, John Turturro, Matt Dillon, and Bridget Fonda. Alison Anders' earlier films are Gas Food Lodging and Mi Vida Loca. Last year, she received a MacArthur Genius Grant for her work as a screenwriter and director. Terry Gross spoke with Alison Anders this week about the music in her new film.
You decided to commission songwriters to write new songs in the style of the late 50s and early 60s for your film, as opposed to actually using real songs from that period. Why did you go with the idea of new songs?
Well, for one thing, I felt like, you know, if I suddenly had Denise busting out with Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow, or, one of the brilliant songs that Ellie wrote for the Shangri-Las, everybody would be like, she didn't write that. So I was very, very careful. I mean, and even I know that at one point Lieber and Stoller had said, well, we've got some songs that weren't big hits, you know, but they'd submit those to us, and it was like, no, I even know these songs, so I know there's going to be some diehard people that know these songs, you know, even though they weren't hits for them, they were songs that a lot of, you know, connoisseurs of the period definitely know. So the thing was that it became very important to write the new songs, and it also, you know, we needed to write things that were specific for the particular scenes, you know, that we were trying to get across certain information. But with each song, I had a model for, I had usually about 5 songs for the songwriters to model their song on.
Well, one of the songs that you commissioned was Born to Love That Boy, which was co-written by Larry Klein, who's the music director for the film, and by Jerry Goffin, who used to be Carole King's songwriting partner and husband. Now I have to say that the husband in the movie does not come off very well. Tell me why you decided to approach Jerry Goffin and ask him to write one of the songs.
Well, we approached just about everybody. I mean, we certainly went after everyone. Karen Rackman, my music supervisor, and myself, we just kind of went down the list of people who were writing during the Brill Building period, and Jerry was one of those people that we approached, and they all got the script, you know, and he got the script. And when I first met him, it was really funny because I thought, oh, I was just sick with nervousness, you know. And he was so hilarious. He says, well, Howard is me, and Denise is Carole. And he went on like, and he says, but how'd you know about this? Or how'd you know about that? And I go, I just made all that stuff up, you know. And finally, I realized I was channeling Jerry Goffin when I wrote this script. But he said some funny things. He was like, well, so Alison, this is my life, and either I'm going to be involved with this film or I'm going to sue you. So it was the answer I wanted to hear because I really wanted Jerry involved. So he wrote 3 songs for us. He wrote one song with Larry Klein, which kind of was reminiscent of stuff that he might have written with Carole for the Shirelles, very early sort of girl group call and response kind of song. Then he also wrote a Flamingos-type song, ballad with Los Lobos. And then he also wrote a late 60s folk sort of Nick Drake kind of song with his and Carole's daughter Louise Goffin and David Berwald. So he really kind of ran the gamut of different types of writing and showed that he's every bit as, you know, good and prolific today as he was then.
Well, I want to play the song that Jerry Goffin co-wrote with the music director for your film, Larry Klein. And the song is called Born to Love That Boy. What were the songs you suggested they pattern this song on?
You know, it was pretty much like the Foolish Little Girl, Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow, a lot of that early 60s advice songs.
Well, let's hear it.
He doesn't love me, but I love him so. Always thinking of that boy, but he never thinks of me. My heart's a toy, and like a little child, he breaks it when he's through. He fools around and he puts me down, but there's nothing I can do. I just live for the moments with him.
Be careful.
His touch is soft and the lights are dim.
Watch out.
Oh, what a trance he puts me in. I guess that I was born to love that boy.
She was born to love that boy.
Love that boy.
It's Born to Love That Boy, one of the songs that Alison Anders commissioned for her new movie, Grace of My Heart, which is about a songwriter in the late 50s and early 60s. Now, who are the singers on that recording?
They are these amazing girls called For Real. Karen Rackman had worked with them once before on one of the drive-in movies projects for Showtime. And it was interesting because I had to really find girls that could get back to that sort of pre-Aretha-sounding girl group vocal. And that was not easy to do because girls have a lot of... there's a lot of girl vocal groups now, but they have been so influenced by that post-Aretha period, which I mean sort of much more edgy and much more of a gospel sound, which... You know, in order to make that kind of crossover into white audiences, the girls had to sort of take that black vocal sound out of their voices in the early 60s. So I needed girls that could do that now. So somehow, For Real, they managed to really be able to get back to that sort of pre-Motown sound and pre-Muscle Shoals sound. And they were just a godsend for me.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Alison Anders. She wrote and directed the new movie, Grace of My Heart. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Alison Anders, she wrote and directed the new movie Grace of My Heart, which is about a Carole King-type songwriter in the late 50s and early 60s. One of the scenes in your new movie has to do with a singer who seems very much to be patterned on Leslie Gore. She has that hairsprayed flip. She wears very schoolish kind of formal clothes. And... when she meets the songwriters in the movie, the songwriters figure out that this singer has a big secret. She's a lesbian. And so they figure they will keep her secret, but they will write a song about a secret love.
Mm-hmm.
Now, tell me about the story behind this song.
Well, certainly... I was very interested in a lot of stuff that Leslie Gore has said about that period, being a performer during that time. She has an amazing feminist perspective on those years and has shown a very contrary part of herself to what her songs were like. Although when you hear, I mean, I don't think there's more of a feminist anthem from that period than You Don't Own Me. And she's talked very much about her frustration being a girl singer during that period. So I was very curious that she was sort of the last person you would have thought of Leslie Gore that would have had that kind of perspective and self-awareness even at that time of herself as a woman in the business.
Right, and her big hit was, It's My Party.
Absolutely, yeah. It's just, it's really amazing. I think that Leslie Gore, there should be a whole movie on her, really. So I was very interested in that, and I've always been a huge fan of Leslie Gore anyway, myself, and so it was a real dream come true when she read the script and agreed to write this song with Larry Klein and David Berwald called My Secret Love, for a character that was pretty clearly inspired by her and was tributing what I love so much about her work.
Well, this is the song My Secret Love, co-written by Leslie Gore for the new film Grace of My Heart. It's sung by Miss Lily Banquet of the cocktail group Combustible Edison.
Love has never been easy for me. Can't you see? I have always been lonely. Faith, it seems like a have to hide our hearts away. If only we could live one day without the need to hide away. I'd tell the truth to everyone how I live for you, but people never understand. They'll destroy us if they can. Say we were struck down by the
That's My Secret Love, co-written by Leslie Gore, from the new film Grace of My Heart, which was written and directed by my guest Allison Anders. And the film pays tribute to songwriters of the late 50s and early 60s. All of the singing on this film isn't done by the actual performers. You know, like, for instance, the part of the Leslie Gore inspired character is played by Bridget Fonda, but she doesn't do the singing. Even the main character in the movie doesn't do her own singing. Why did you decide to have all the singing dubbed by actual singers as opposed to finding actors who could sing and do both things themselves?
Well, I think that something happened to musical films, musical dramas, after the 40s and 50s. Back in the 40s and 50s, you could kind of, you know, almost everyone sang and danced and acted, but people stopped doing that at some point, stopped having all those skills. So for me, it's like I tend to get thrown out if I see Whitney Houston in a movie, for example. I just always go, oh, it's Whitney Houston the singer. I can never quite get past the persona, even though I always cast a lot of musicians in my films. But you have to cast them in such a way that for a lead or for a very significant part, I find it pretty difficult because I'm always wrapped up in their personas as a performer, a musical performer, than I am as their believability as an actor. So that became a big issue for me, was that, well, I think I would rather choose actors, you know, and then, you know, find singers to do the voices than to have to battle, you know, someone else's persona as a musician in trying to make my actors believable.
One of the new songs written for your movie was composed by Elvis Costello and Burt Bacharach. What an interesting combination. And it's a it's a great song called God Give Me Strength. Now, tell us the story behind the song.
Well, first off, it was, you know, it was part of this process that Karen Rackman, my music supervisor, and I went through, and, you know, of like kind of looking at songwriters of the era and then matching them with songwriters of the present. And it was her idea to put Bert and Elvis together, which I just was knocked out by. I thought, oh my God, that is so brilliant. And I knew that I wanted this particular song to sound like a Burt Bacharach song from the mid-60s, in the vein of Make It Easy on Yourself or Anyone Who Had a Heart, or, you know, even What the World Needs Now is Love, like one of those classic sort of 60s Burt ballads. And so the first thing that we did was Karen got a hold of Burt Bacharach, and I talked to Burt, and she said, just find out who he wants to write with first. And he named three people, and one of them was Elvis. So that was great, because it totally validated this bizarre and inspired idea of Karen's. And then we talked. I called Elvis, and that was it was pretty easy. It was an easy sell for Elvis. And his feeling was really great. He was like, well, I feel like, you know, I can help him revisit that period because of my experience with working with Paul McCartney and writing songs with him. I was able to help Paul revisit a period he had left behind. And this hadn't even occurred to me, of course, that naturally artists move on and they don't necessarily want to go back to a previous time in their creative repertoire. But he was able to do that, and Bert was completely open and willing. It was so great. I mean, it's just like, it's like such a magical collaboration, really, with the two of them. It was very exciting.
Alison Anders, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Alison Anders speaking with Terry Gross about her new film, Grace of My Heart. Coming up, we'll hear an excerpt from Terry's interview with Elvis Costello about the influence Burt Bacharach had on his own music and their collaboration on the song God Give Me Strength, featured in Anders' film. First, let's take a short break. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Earlier this summer, Terry Gross spoke with Elvis Costello about his new album, All This Useless Beauty. She also talked with him about working with Burt Bacharach on the title song for Alison Anders' film, Grace of My Heart.
Now, I understand you co-wrote a song with Burt Bacharach recently.
I did, yeah.
that you haven't recorded. How did you get together with him? And let me preface this by saying that his approach to songwriting is so different than yours, because he's an almost like post-Tin Pan Alley type of songwriter who's always written for other people.
Mm. Well, I think that he's not as dissimilar as it might appear, except in one obvious respect, that he is, I mean, he is classically trained to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
His experience of music is considerably broader and more varied than my own, where I started, you know, I really started out as a guitar-playing songwriter, whatever that's called. And so, you know, there's no point of comparison in that, but over the years, I have made reference to his style on a few occasions, a number of songs. Quite a well-known song of mine that I did on my third album, Armed Forces, Accidents Will Happen, doesn't sound anything like him, but in fact, I distinctly remember sitting down at the piano and trying to work out Anyone Who Had a Heart as a kind of model, as something that I wanted to approach.
Really?
And I had several songs in mind of the kind of complexity that he could achieve. So Later on, I tried on a number of occasions to write in his style. I even covered a couple of his songs. I covered Just Don't Know What to Do with Myself, and later on I covered Baby, It's You.
And any chance that you could play a bit of the song that you co-wrote with Burt Bacharach?
I'd love to, but unfortunately it's a piano song and there's no piano in the room.
Oh.
And also, truthfully, we are in a talk studio here, and although sort of, you know, quiet ballads, which are more conversational, are possible, this is a song that really requires to be sung in a singing space. It's very rangy.
Could you do just a few lines of it a cappella? Just to give us a sense of the melody?
Well, I'll give you the sense. I mean, here's what, to answer your question, how did we write this? This is how we wrote. I met Burt in about 1988, I think it was, 89, when I was working on the record Spike in Los Angeles. And I was shamelessly stealing his instrumental arrangement devices to dress up a song of mine, a very long, unwieldy song called Satellite, which was on the album Spike. And he happened to be down the hall while I was doing it. It was like one of those very strange coincidences. And we met, and I played him the song, and he was very, very generous about our you know, shameless stealing of his devices. And we didn't really get in touch then, and we were put in touch in the course of this film that's being completed at the moment by Alison Anders called Grace of My Heart. They came up with the idea of me and Burt Bacharach writing this song together, which is a big, dramatic, romantic ballad. Unfortunately, due to the deadlines of the film, we were unable to get together in the same room, so this song was written by fax and telephone line, which is one of the more terrifying things I've had to do in my life. I had to sort of make a start. I had a title, and I played just a demo, which will probably sound about as scratchy as these opening bars, of my opening statement of melody down the phone while I was planning on playing it to Burt over the phone and talking him through it. Unfortunately, the day I called, he was out, and I got his answering machine. And anybody who's ever done that thing of saying something to the answering machine, only wishing there was some button you could press to erase it, will know the feeling of terror shortly after I put the phone down. I said, what have I done? I've just played this sort of scratchy little demo down the phone to this, you know, person I've admired for 20 years or more, and there's no way of clawing it back. Anyway, he was kind enough to ring back soon after and make, you know, some really wise choices of changes in the harmony. And shortly afterwards, some music appeared in my fax, and you know, that was the music for the next part of the song, and I fitted the words to it. And little by little, we pieced the song together over the next 10 days. So there you go. I'll just play a little bit of it.
Great.
Now I have nothing, so God give me strength, 'cause I'm weak in a way. And if I'm strong, I might still break. And I don't have anything to share that I won't throw away into the air. That song is sung out. This bell is rung out. She was the light that I'd bless. She took my last chance of happiness. So God, give me strength. God, give me strength. There was a little preview there.
I like that a lot.
It's a pretty tune. I mean,
let me ask you. I'm sorry. You know what I really love? Is there any chance that you could play a couple of the lines the way you wrote it and then show us the harmonic changes that Burt Bacharach made?
No, there isn't really, no, because I would have to. For one thing, I can't remember what they were originally, because this has become fixedly the version of the song. And secondly, you would need a piano to really illustrate that. You wouldn't hear it on the guitar.
Right.
It's very hard. I mean, what's interesting is I can play you a few bars of the bridge. to show you the contrast, because that opening statement, with minus the amendments, is largely my invention, because somebody has to start things rolling. So the second time round, it gets to the bridge, it goes, God give me strength, God, if she'd grant me her indulgence and decline, I might as well wipe her from her memory. See what I mean? That's where the problem is. It starts getting very high. And it's not really designed to be done in here, I don't think.
Right.
But, I mean, that's where the language of the harmony completely changes there, you know. And it goes into a whole other world, which I won't pursue now, because it really doesn't sound like very much without the full accompaniment. You know, you need 20 strings and a couple of flugelhorns to go up there, you know. So God give me strength. God should grant me her indulgence and decline. My memory, friendship, the spell, she becomes my enemy. And maybe I was washed out like a lip print on a shirt. See, I'm only human, I want him to
Elvis Costello singing God Give Me Strength from the soundtrack of Grace of My Heart. Terry Gross spoke with him in June. Tomorrow, we'll hear from some of the Brill Building's best-known singers and songwriters, Ellie Greenwich, Carole King, Lieberman Stoller, and Ronnie Spector, on the archive edition of Fresh Air. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet with Tracy Tannenbaum. Research assistance from Siobhan Roth. Joan Tuohy-Westman produced today's Fresh Air. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
She was the lamp that I'd bless. She took my last chance of happiness. So God give me strength. God give me strength.
Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.